I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. In October of 1985, a woman named Cherie Warren left work at a busy Salt Lake City office
to meet her estranged husband at a downtown auto dealership.
She never made it home. Cherie's car surfaced weeks later in Las Vegas.
In the parking lot of a hotel casino.
No one knows how it got there.
Strange. It was strange.
Both Cherie's estranged husband and her boyfriend raised suspicion for investigators.
I kind of thought that he might have done something.
But no arrests were ever made. In Cold Season 3, we dig into double lives, make new connections in the case, and examine the difficulty raised by reasonable doubt.
We want answers just as much as anyone else.
They have creeps like that now too, so nothing's changed.
That's the new Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie. Now available anywhere you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Jason Lee, along with Amy Donaldson, and welcome to the Loudmouth Project's Voices of Reason. On this episode, we're joined by a friend of our show and Utah political consultant, Ann Dent. And my, oh my, there is so much to begin with, starting with the fact that our president, as we found out early this morning or late last night, however you want to describe it, he and First Lady Melania Trump have tested positive for COVID-19, and they are now under quarantine for the next couple of weeks. And after so long having kind of downplayed the impact of coronavirus, not wearing a mask for the longest time, having large-scale events, without masks, and then only recently beginning to wear them sparingly, we find that he had been actually not feeling as well, you know, during some of those events as he had been previously. And we now know it probably was because he had come down, contracted the virus. And it first came to light when his communications director, Hope Hicks, had also tested positive. And then there's others in the close White House inner circle who may also be potentially infected, though we do know that Mike Pence and his wife have tested negative thus far. So, ladies, I want to ask, I'll start with you, Ann. What are your thoughts when you first heard about this?
I think the first thoughts were, I mean, this was inevitable, right? And I was doing my nightly Twitter surfing and came across the president's tweet. This is how he announces things. You know, the first lady and I have tested positive for the first time he's ever said COVID-19. Usually he calls it the China virus, but when he tests positive for it, he calls it COVID-19. It's just so ironic. You know, there was the debate the other night and he is berating Joe Biden for wearing a large mask. And Joe, you wear a mask everywhere you go. You are always in a mask. And it's just the irony of it is huge. And Tuesday, Hope Hicks test positive, and I know they all knew, and he was still in public with people. He's not a big mask wearer, and he hosts a fundraiser on Thursday, and it's just such negligence, and it just shows how much he's taken this seriously. It shows really why this country is struggling with this COVID virus, because we've had a lack of leadership and, you know, our leaders have not taken it seriously. It's unfortunate.
So my thoughts, you know, I agree with what Ann said that I think that to some degree it was inevitable, because we do know that, you know, continuing to, you know, go about your life in a normal way and be in close contact with people, especially indoors, is a huge risk factor. And they're meeting so many people from all over the country and sometimes all over the world. And I think we've heard about a couple of close calls where other foreign diplomats have tested positive after meeting with the president or the vice president. And so I do feel like they're at greater risk anyway, because, I mean, you can't telecommute that job. You have to go out and do it. But he's also been attending some indoor rallies and, you know, something that during the debate, I think he said he had one, but that's not true. I think he had another one planned coming up this week. But so I guess here's my thoughts. I think everyone should read the section of The Great Influenza by John Barry where he describes President Wilson coming down with the flu. He got the influenza during the Treaty of Versailles negotiations, and he was incredibly sick. They had some of the negotiations in his room. It completely changed the dynamic of the negotiation, and it really led to him conceding some things that he was pretty hardline on at the beginning, including basically gutting Germany's military. And he was, I wonder sometimes, had he done things that, had he gotten his way, had they, that treaty been different, if we wouldn't have had World War II. That was his thought, but he never spoke about influenza. He never acknowledged it. He never gave advice about it. He did the opposite of Trump. He instead of talking about it and calling a hoax, he just said, nobody's allowed to report on it. Nobody's allowed to talk about it. The media was not allowed to say this is a real thing. That was a tremendous problem. And I'm sure we lost, thousands more lives because of that, the way he handled it. And they do believe now, doctors who've looked at his autopsy reports and his medical records, that it did impact him. And there is a brain fog that accompanies COVID. They've done studies on this. It impacts people's hearts. It impacts people's brains. It impacts their lungs, sometimes long-term. And we don't know right now what those long-term effects will be or if they go away, if there's anything that can be done to mitigate them. It's a very serious illness. And I think that I'm heartbroken that we have this kind of leadership that sort of denied it or said it's not that big a deal because there's two options, you recover or you die. And there's all this space in between, and there's a lot of suffering going on because of it. And I just think that different leadership, more empathetic leadership, more compassionate leadership, maybe would have been different. But I also struggle with blaming him for getting sick, because I know so many people who did everything that they were asked to do and took every precaution and got sick. And there's a lot of stigma attached to the virus, and a lot of people don't even want to talk about how they got it. And I really think we do need to have open, honest discussions to understand, how it's being spread and what we can do to mitigate it. And I've learned from the people that who've been infected when they tell me their stories, but a lot of them don't want to tell them on the record. I just think there are a lot of issues that this creates, and it's going to make it, I wish this virus was not a political issue. That's what I wish. I wish that this had remained a medical issue, and we could argue about all kinds of other topics. But as far as medical issues, like, listen to the doctors, listen to scientists, and do what they ask us to do. It's a medical issue, not a political issue.
And I want to ask you, if you could, politically speaking, what impact might this have on the election as we approach it in only a few weeks?
So that was a huge, so then, this tweet comes out, and then it is, I'm one that loves our media. I'm always just so incessantly on every channel watching everything, and just immediately Sanjay Gupta at 1 a.m. gets in a suit and is, on CNN and MSN as 24-hour coverage of the president, and all of the theories going around. And, I probably had 20 texts saying, what do you think is going to happen? Do you think he's really positive? Why do you think that they're doing this now? And I can't for sure say if this is a political strategy move from somebody who works on campaigns in a much smaller level. I tend to think everything is done for strategy when we're campaigning. I think that this debate went so badly. One reason would be he's not going to be able to do debates for the next 2 weeks. And another tactic is that, he could say, okay, I worked through COVID and it was hardly anything for me. So COVID's not a big deal. I've had the flu and it's worse. And I can see him in this administration pushing through that line saying, COVID's not a big deal. We can get through this. And so I don't know the strategy of this administration or why, or they've release this right now, but I think that there's some underlying motives, and I think that those will be clear in the next couple of days. I mean, already they've canceled debates, and so I think that there will obviously be an effect on the elections. And we're just going to have, it's really sad because we, as, you know, citizens and living in this country, we're a little bit powerless, and we're just going to have to watch and see how this plays out.
When we come back, we will have continue our discussion a little bit on COVID as it relates. We're going to bring it a little bit closer, though, and see how it's affecting states, including our own. And you're listening to Voices of Reason.
It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLPodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to Voices of Reason. I am Jason Lee, along with Amy Donaldson. Today, we're joined by Ann Dent, political consultant here in Utah. And we're talking about, last segment, we talked about the president testing positive for COVID-19. But locally here in Utah, we have been setting records on the daily. At one point, we had over 1,100 cases in a day. I think it was even, one day might have even been even higher. But for the longest time, we'd hoped to get under 400. Now, we are on the order of 900 to 1,000 almost a day because school has gone back in and people are taking fewer precautions. And, of course, young people think they'll live forever, so they don't do very much in the way of, social distancing or minding their just ideas of safety in general because, they don't really that doesn't resonate with them. And I want to know, I'm going to ask Ann to kind of join in here, What in the heck is going on here?
Wow. If I could answer that, Jason, I think I would be a millionaire. But I think that one of the things that's going on is our electeds, a lot of our electeds are not taking this seriously. And because we are in an election, they are not doing the things that we really need to be doing to see this number, see these numbers going down. I was really disturbed on Tuesday. There was really a great debate before the notorious debate. Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox and Chris Peterson, both running for governor, had a great debate. And one of the things that was addressed was the COVID response. And Spencer Cox said, the Salt Lake City School District is the only school district in the state that has not gone back to in-person learning. And that's a huge mistake. And as a parent of a child in the Salt Lake School District, West High School, which is in, major hotspot, I just thought this is why, one of the reasons our numbers are so high is this is so political. And as Amy said earlier, this should not be about politics. We need a mask mandate statewide. And I'm really, really discouraged by the leadership. Really discouraged.
Let me ask you about the mask mandate. Do you think it would be, what difference do you think it would make? I've seen people wear it. Some of us comply because we listen to the science. Some people comply because it's required and they want to go do things. But there are people who are really adamantly opposed to this and they take great pleasure in defying both the rules of private businesses and the rules of any mandate from the government. And there really isn't a way to enforce it. So, I definitely think a mask mandate would get more compliance because a lot of people just don't want the hassle if it's mandated and it gives cover to businesses. But I just wonder about that because I definitely think we should all be wearing masks, but I wonder about the mandate. What do you think, Anne?
Yeah. I absolutely think a mask mandate makes a difference. I mean, Salt Lake County implemented, Mayor Wilson pushed back and implemented a mask mandate, and our numbers went down. And there are going to be the people, of course, that are pushing against it and saying, you know, you can't enforce this. It also hurts, you know, Utah County has a mask mandate, and their Utah County Sheriff said, we will for sure not be enforcing this. Well, that does not help. I'm so grateful for our leadership in Salt Lake County that has, you know, not said that and backed up our county government that is enforcing this. Enforcing it meaning, let's get out here, let's wear a mask, let's do it for ourselves and other people. So I think it's more of an example. And obviously, you know, no, people are going to fight against this. But I think that when there's mandates, it also shows that our leadership is taking this seriously and that they are pushing effective and really powerful change for this. And not just, you know, I'm really frustrated by the weekly governor's COVID pressers where he's talking about, let's just be kind to each other and let's just expect each other to wear masks.
And also I should point out that people are sharing pictures of our leaders at fundraisers without masks. And, you know, anyone who's a parent knows this, if you don't put on a helmet or wear a seatbelt, your kid's not going to put on a seatbelt. They're not going to do it except when you make them. Right. So if you want that to be drilled into somebody, you have to do it yourself. And I think there's some of that as well.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, we are not leading as a state in, you know, our mandates are, and, you know, we have some electeds that are trying to push, but our majority is, you know, is not pushing. And we see it in our progress, which is, it's frightening.
I want to jump in here because one thing I want to say is that the reason the Utah County Sheriff said that about not reinforcing is because there are bigger things going on. That if he just had to give a ticket or arrest somebody for not wearing a mask, they would do nothing else. And so it as Amy kind of described, it is unenforceable in the sense that there are several million people in this state, and having that be the thing that police focus their attention on, trying to make people do that, is, it literally would be a nightmare. And so that's what he meant. Not that I don't think it was the idea that he's going to let anarchy reign. It was putting too much pressure and on law enforcement to then do something that really should be an individual mandate themselves. And you can do the best you can to get people to do it. But I don't want to push him under the bus because it sounded different than it really was meant. It's sort of like defunding the police. They really need a better marketing strategy, right? I want to mention, though, that, you know, in a case where we know that this is a serious circumstance, and we only got about a minute to go, I know that folks should be more aware of these numbers getting bigger. It's putting a big tax on our healthcare system, because that's what we really got to worry about. If more people get sick, more people have to go to the hospital, that means resources are being used when we could do better by being smarter. And when this lieutenant governor mentions that people aren't going to school, this is why they shouldn't be going to school. Because before that happened, we had fewer people getting sick, and having them be online, away from each other, is better than this alternative. And I know we want people to go back, we want things to go back to normal, we want kids to be in school, but we got to figure out a way to manage this rather than do what is, you know, quote unquote convenient for parents who want to get the kids out and maybe the kids who want to go back to school. This is just one of those times when we got to buck up and do what is right for our entire community. And it's not going back to school, creating hundreds and hundreds of new cases each and every day. When we come back, we're going to switch topics a little bit. And Amy wants to talk about the Supreme Court nomination of Amy Coney Barrett and its implications wide-ranging across this country and what that looks like in our current political climate. You're listening to Voices of Reason. We are back with the Loudmouth Project's Voices of Reason. I'm Jason Lee, along with Amy Donaldson. Today, joined by friend of our show and political consultant, Ann Dent. And Amy, you were wanting to chat about the Supreme Court nomination of Amy Coney Barrett. This is in the wake of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's passing a couple of weeks ago. And right now, this has become one of the hot political issues around the country. And in a sense, it's a historic time. This will be another female justice, which always is good, but it also, there's a lot of underlying issues with her nomination.
Yeah, and I think what bothers me about just the discussion around it is that there's been a lot of people have been setting up rules about, right? They've been saying, you're going to attack her faith, or you're going to treat a conservative woman badly, or that we don't define conservative women as feminists. And all of these things, all this controversy has been created before anyone has, even any congressperson, and even the Senate, has had the chance to debate it. I haven't even really seen a lot of these things in the media, except that these are the things that some conservative people are saying, that these are going to happen. And what I feel is a little bit gaslit in that they're telling me there are certain things I can't ask questions about, that I can't talk about. And, you know, I, for one, think women get treated incredibly poorly. If you want to see a woman get treated absolutely appallingly bad, go back and watch the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings and see how they treated Anita Hill when she brought forward allegations of sexual harassment against Clarence Thomas. And I watched that as a young reporter and thought, I don't think I'll ever report sexual harassment. This is the worst thing I've ever seen. It was horrible. And, it set us up, I think. But so I think the problem for me is there are legitimate issues with where is the line between your personal opinions and faith and beliefs and public policy. And I know people want to make it an issue of attacking her religious faith, but I think that's a legitimate thing to understand. I also feel like we're giving the 9 people of the Supreme Court way too much power. We need to start asking Congress to do their jobs and actually legislate. 66% of this country supports Roe v. Wade as law. That's what Congress should do. They should pass and protect women's right to have health care. Basically, that's what I see it as. It's health care. And if they could put that into law, obviously they're going to get sued about it. But it's a much better solution than just praying that, you know, someone on the Supreme Court will do the right thing. I think we have in our history evidence that the court gets stuff wrong. You can look at Dred Scott, the Japanese internment camps, Citizens United. Those are all decisions that the Supreme Court made that have had horrible negative ramifications for, if not most of the citizens of this country, all of us. And so I think that let's stop looking for a savior in the Supreme Court and start pushing our legislators to do what they were hired to do.
And your thoughts?
I agree with you, Amy, but I also, you know, there is this underlying also thing that I've been observing. Amy Coney Barrett is absolutely qualified to do a lot of things, and she's, you know, accomplished. But as a woman, it also seems interesting that how we approach her, right? They are now asking, and I think this also goes along with the lines of what you're saying, is that I'm so appalled that we still anybody is okay with saying, like, she has 7 kids. How, or I don't know how many kids she has, but she has many kids. How could she do this job with 5 or more kids? How could, and I'm definitely not saying that I am, you know, I think that she'd be the person for this appointment, but the way we look at women in roles needs to change. And I've never heard questions asked about males that we ask about females when we're looking at them for these positions. And in 2020, it's still so prevalent. And just shocking to me. It is extremely, extremely disheartening raising a child, a daughter, knowing that, like, you know, if she goes for a job and they're asking these questions that no one really asks about males that are going for the same position. Just shocking to me in 2020.
I 100% agree with that. I've been asked those questions. How do you, like, when I worked on the news desk, I did night police when I had Rachel, my oldest daughter, and I can't tell you the number of times inside the building and out from sources, what do you do with your kid while you're working? And I'm absolutely positive my colleagues who had children the same age were not asked those questions. And I 100% agree, but I also think we have to also kind of constantly ask ourselves, is this relevant to the job, right? Not the kid thing. I definitely don't think that how many kids you have or are you a good mom or a bad mom? I think those things are completely irrelevant. Where does who she is and what she's doing and what she believes and how she rules, the things she's written, the things she's said, how do those impact the rest of us? That's what I care about. She can do whatever she wants. She can be an amazing mom. That's not even relevant to me, to what's happening. To me, it's all about how do we talk about, I mean, I have a kid whose civil rights are at risk with some of her beliefs. Is she going to bring those personal beliefs into her public rulings? Those are my concerns.
When I think about this, and these are the same concerns that anybody would have over any justice nomination, right? And I think what we worry about in general, because we kind of lean pretty far left, comparatively, that the reason we know that the Supreme Court is a political body, and composed of partisanship based on the people who are nominated. And the presidents who nominate them, whether they're Democrat or Republican, they choose people they hope and from their backgrounds would lead them to, you know, pursue agendas that would, you know, follow what their beliefs are. But there's got to be some part of them, and this is what keeps me going, because otherwise I would lose faith in the entire system, that they try to believe what the law is. Now, there's always certain different interpretations. That's why they have 9 of these people, all of whom are very smart and very capable. And you just hope that even though she may be a conservative person in her life, that she recognizes, hopefully, that just because that's the way she lives her life, that isn't the way everybody else should have to live theirs. And that shouldn't necessarily be a law based on her personal beliefs, or anybody's for that matter, whether they're liberal or conservative. And I do worry about that, because there's a reason they picked her. And there's a reason a lot of legal scholars are thinking that Roe v. Wade is going down pretty soon. But there's part of me that hopes that though I don't believe in, I'm not a God-fearing guy or a religious person, that common sense will tell them that even though I may not like it, it still may be something that the rest of the world could benefit from, and that's really all that keeps me going. Because otherwise, I feel as though I would be downtrodden in my thoughts, and have little faith in the system in general. Last comment, Amy, when you think about this, do you worry about her personal beliefs?
I do, because I think that, I mean, just like I think you can't be always aware of your racial bias or your gender bias. Those are things you constantly have to challenge and be educating yourself about and on guard about. I think that your faith frames your decisions. And I don't know what her personal belief is on how to separate that. Some people I have a lot of faith in. I mean, Joe Biden is a Catholic, but he's come out publicly and said, you know, how he would separate his personal beliefs from his public policy. And I think he's evolved over on some of those issues, which I think is what we all do. And she's young. I absolutely think having faith is a good thing. I think it frames who you are and how you make decisions. And that's my concern. But I also know that the court, when people get there, and the gravity of being the moral conscience and interpreter of laws for the country is a weighty thing, and people don't always do what you think they will do. So I just still think the answer to our distress with Roe v. Wade or anything else, there's a lot of other things that are at issue, is for the Congress to step up and do their job. And then you know, it doesn't matter so much if we have Supreme Court justices that bring in their personal beliefs or don't.
When we come back, I want to ask one final question as we approach the biggest election of the next big election of our lifetime. Does character count anymore in the candidates and people we choose for elected office? And it's been something that's rolling in my head around for a while, and I want to ask you two about that and get your thoughts. You're listening to Voices of Reason. Welcome back. I am Jason Lee, along with Amy Donaldson, and we are joined by Ann Dent, Utah political consultant and friend of our show. And I wanted to come up and speak on this last segment about character. You know, it used to be something that people cared about. I remember watching this. If you ever had a chance to watch The American President, Michael Douglas, Annette Bening, it was very good movie. And actually, a bunch of people on it, Martin Sheen, there were a lot of people in that show who ended up being on The West Wing, my favorite TV show of all time, by the way. And where is Josiah Bartlett when I need him to be the president right now? So character was a thing. In fact, that was one of the issues brought up in that fictional campaign when Michael Douglas was running against Richard Dreyfuss's conservative character. Character in the show, not character personally. When I look at the people we have to choose from, because certainly President Trump has character issues, and I would say the same of Joe Biden, because Amy brought up last segment about how he was involved in the Anita Hill proceedings when that all happened with Clarence Thomas. And to be honest with you, it was not his finest day. He showed himself to be a chauvinist pig. And he was one of the leaders. He, along with Orrin Hatch, they were terrible. And they were one of the deplorables at the time, I would say. I wonder then, as we come today, we have seemed to be willing to accept dreadful behavior from a lot of people, whether they're male or female, by the way. And when people ask me, when the reason I don't like Donald Trump is not because of his presidency, it's because I just think he's a terrible person. He is a womanizer. He doesn't know the truth, or he never uses it or speaks it, and he is intellectually uncurious, and he's all of the things that you wouldn't want in a person who is going to make life-altering decisions for the entire country. And Joe Biden has a lot of flaws, too, because he, too, has had made questionable decisions in his political life and personal life, by the way. And so you ask yourself, why don't we pick people who have fewer of these flaws? And I wanted to get... Ann, you deal in this kind of thing all the time. Does character matter anymore?
You know, normally I would scream, yes, it does, Jason. I think it does. We have amazing electeds. We run amazing electeds. But this cycle and this administration living in Utah has really, I can't yell that right now. I've watched our majority leadership either stay silent or really stand behind this president that I saw a tweet the other day that said, it's not that he's a bad president, he's a bad person. And so many of our electeds really, really defend him. And I don't know if it's just this sheep thing, it's this, you know, straight ticket, like I have to support who my party is supporting. But where do you say, and I have so much respect for Republican leadership right now that are going out of their comfort zone and are saying, I am not going to support this president or this administration. I am not okay with what's happening. And I think that is happening. And so is there character? Yes, there is. Are people finding it hard to use their voice? Absolutely. I don't know why that is. It's unfortunate because more than ever, we need leadership that's going to stand up and use their voice and say, this is not okay. And if I'm going to be shunned by my party, I'm okay with that. But I have to stand up for what's right. So I think that there are good. There is character, and character is important, and people are looking for that. So I think that this is not like a straight yes or no answer. I think that it's really complex. And I want to say that there are really great elected officials, and we are looking for that, and people are watching for that, and people are watching for who's supporting what right now, for sure.
Yeah, I think that until there is a real reward for being principled, right now there's a huge penalty for coming out and being principled and putting country over party, or putting your principles over your party affiliation. I think the reward has to be greater than the penalty. I feel like what we've learned through some unfortunate character flaws becoming public issues in the last 30 years or so, from my perspective, and really it started with Watergate, is that because we used to, you know, hands off, and it's not that these guys have less character. It's that we report everything now. We talk about everything now. Everything is, for some of us, relevant, and some of us, what matters is power. And if I have to use a bad person to get to power, that's okay. And I just go back to one of my favorite sayings by a guy named John Lund, is you cannot do the Lord's work with the devil's tools. And I just feel like, that you're never going to have a perfect candidate. And obviously there's lots of flawed people out there trying to do good things, but you have to ask yourself, what policies are they putting forth? And, what are they doing publicly? Like, I don't think Mitt Romney is a perfect person. Absolutely not. But I think he's got a set of principles, and they guide what he does. And sometimes I agree with him, and sometimes I don't. But I think he pretty much tries to stick to those same principles whenever he's making decisions in policy. And the problem is there's no reward for him. So will he win re-election if he tries to run again? I think so, because Republicans really have a stronghold here. But, you know, if he was in a tight race, like, say, Ben McAdams is, he might have it might be much more risky for him to stick to those principles and go against his party as often as he has, even when all he's doing is pointing out something that really we all agree with, like just a small, like, this is an appalling thing to say, or the president shouldn't insult somebody. You know, what I think are really simple, basic manners. But I think until there is a reward for politicians to be principled conflict with the party or override the party, I just don't think that a lot of them will do it, because they want to stay in power. They want to keep their jobs.
I'm going to let that be the last word. And I want to say, Ann Dent, thank you again for joining us. We really appreciate you being with us again. And join us again for the next episode of the Loudmouth Project's Voices of Reason. If you have any comments about the show, please contact us via email at vormed@gmail.com or at vrjasonl@gmail.com. Or you can find us on Twitter at @adonsports and at @jasonlee1. Our show's Twitter handle is @VORpodcast. Check out our Facebook page, and you can also find and subscribe to free episodes of our podcast in all the places where you find interesting content. Be sure to review our show as well. We'd love to get your feedback, and it helps us grow our audience. Until next time, I'm Jason Lee, along with Amy Donaldson. When you engage in passionate debate, do your best to keep your dialogue civil. Try to be the voice of reason.
Voices of Reason is a production of a Loudmouth Project.
Thank you.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
There's desperation and anguish.
More than 80,000 Afghans have since arrived in America, but this story is still unfolding. I'm Andreas Martin. In my new podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, we'll find out what happens to these new arrivals in our communities. Who would help our newest neighbors? Follow us at kslpodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.